My name is Amanda Newland Davis, and I run Oklahoma Cold Cases along with my partner Jen. At Oklahoma Cold Cases, we try to shine light on the cases of the missing, murdered, and unidentified that otherwise don't get much media attention. For the last 4 years, we've existed solely on Facebook, sharing the posts of the missing, murdered, and unidentified of Oklahoma. But this past year, we've branched out and started a database in which we list all of the names of every cold case that is in Oklahoma that we are currently aware of. You can find us at oklahomacoldcases.org.
You're listening to Sirens, a true crime podcast brought to you by the Sirens Network. This podcast contains explicit content, so listener discretion is advised. The opinions expressed on this podcast are solely the views of the hosts and do not reflect the views of affiliates, associates, or sponsors of this podcast. This is Sirens, a true crime podcast.
My Spotify playlist, I have several that have like a lot of followers, personal playlist. So anyways, I have a classic country playlist that a lot of my friends like to follow. Because it's like you have the back roading experience with me, you know, you can just listen to it anywhere. Yeah. And I'm right there on a dirt road with you. Anyways, so I found out that Spotify has the B.C. Clark anniversary show jingle.
No. How?
I don't know. I put it in there like 8 times, dude.
It's, oh my god.
I get screenshots on the daily and they're like, damn it. I'm like, oh, sorry.
Sorry, not sorry.
But it's so funny because I fucked my brother up real bad with it. The first time it hit him, it was like, there's like probably, God, I don't know. Don't get me to lie. I want to say like upwards of 300 songs on this playlist. So it's not going to hit you very often at all, especially 8 out of like 300, you know? But it came on in July. My brother was like, wait, what the fuck? It's not Christmas.
That's amazing. I'm going to have to add that to my Christmas playlist.
Oh, hell yeah. If you have never lived in Oklahoma during December, go look up the B.C. Clark's anniversary sale song.
We all know it by heart.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Like, you don't even know it's Christmas around here unless you hear it.
Anyway. Oh, to preface this, I noticed this sneaky, she fucking hit record, but when we first got on, which is normally when she catches me, I Rickrolled her. And then she told me that she Rickrolls someone too. So basically, this is just pay it forward. So if you've got someone near and dear to your heart this holiday season.
Yeah. Rickroll. Exactly.
Just let them know you care. You know? Anyway.
This episode that we're doing, I think, holiday special. This is our Christmas special, or, you know, Yule. Whatever you celebrate. But
I like them both.
I like all of them. Happy Kwanzaa, happy Hanukkah, whatever. I mean, you know, you do you, boo-boo. But this story that we're bringing you today is set around Christmas time.
Aww.
After this, there's a little break, and then we'll get back to you after the Christmas break, after the New Year break. So, you know, spend time with your family or face chat them, whatever cute kids are doing these days. Happy holidays. Just wanted to throw that out there.
Oh my gosh, I have a chat that's like going crazy.
I hate it when like I am literally doing nothing all day long and no one talks to me. And then the minute that I'm like get busy, it's like 18 people want to blow up a group chat.
Yeah, don't get me started. Like I won't have any phone calls, won't have texts, won't have anything going on. I start Gilmore nothing. Girls, everything. Start Pornhub,
yes.
Everybody. Like I am... Do not disturb me. You should have disturbed me 30 minutes ago if you want to mess with him. I've moved on. I wanted to give a shout out. We got a heads up that like a whole group loves us. What was it? The East Central Law Department?
The East Central Legal Department.
Legal Department. You.
Hi, hey. East Central Legal Department. Hey, we love you.
East Central University is who we're talking about for everybody that's ECU. You know, go Tigers. Good job.
You love us. We love you. It's mutual. It's a mutual thing.
I hope everyone has a wonderful Christmas. You get to see your families. If you don't, maybe go volunteer somewhere. I think I brought this up last year, but like there's ways to not sit alone at home on a holiday while everyone else is celebrating and posting it all over their news feed and all that kind of stuff.
And you can Zoom people.
Zoom people, yeah, FaceTime, even Snapchat, that'll work.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you don't feel safe going around other people, you know, for certain pandemic reasons right now, do it that way. We've been doing that a lot. My phone's never been used for FaceTime so damn much. So.
Oh, yeah. I've never used Zoom so much in my life. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I agree with that. Try to keep your spirits positive. We're going into a new year. Happy New Year, by the way. Happy New Year. Let's just try to keep our spirits high. Let's fucking do this, man.
All right. It's pretty sad.
Oh, maybe I should introduce this one. So this one is the Babs Switch Christmas Fire of 1924.
Babs. Like Babs Bunny. Babs. Bugs Bunny. Babs.
Babs. Yes. Yes.
Switch. Whatever the shit that means. Where do these names come from?
I don't know, man. It was 1924, so.
I know. You would think with the word switch. I don't know. Switch is like railroady to me.
Ah.
I don't know why I'm.
Could be.
Come back down here. Pulls you down like an escape balloon at a birthday party. I know where Hobart is. I went to college with a guy from Hobart. He's one of my best friends. I loved him to death. Shout out to you, Nick. Miss you, man. Hope you're well.
Babs Switch wasn't too far away from Hobart.
Right, exactly. It's like, so it's down in the southwest corner, kind of Altus, Blair, like down that way.
Like 5 miles south of Hobart. Yeah, there you go. So it's just Babs, Oklahoma now.
Oh, really? See, yeah. The switch thing might have been. Is there a railroad track? You can't see that. Stupid maps.
There probably is.
I just got to tell y'all, we kind of have to go through some kind of sad shit to get to the wow part of this story.
Yeah.
Like you would think the beginning is the part we're talking about, but anyways, it's crazy. This is kind of a crazy story. The fire during the Christmas program is considered among the most devastating fires in Oklahoma's history. In all, 36 died, almost half of them children, after a burning candle on a Christmas tree turned a tiny crowded schoolhouse into an inferno. It is the sixth deadliest school fire on record in the United States. The occurrence during the Christmas season magnified the sense of tragedy. About 200 community members arrived at the one-story schoolhouse that evening for a Christmas Eve program, despite heavy snow and sub-zero temperatures. Engaged couples, grandparents, mothers, fathers, and children packed into the tiny structure, whose windows were covered with metal wiring to keep out prowlers drawn by nearby railroad trucks.
Oh, ooh. No!
Oh.
Nailed it.
Anywho, when you're right, you're right. So after the program concluded, a teenage boy dressed in a Santa suit, he was handing out toys and candy to the children. He bumped a cedar Christmas tree. And back then, they didn't have the fake lights on the Christmas tree. And most were lit with candles all over the tree, which was usually a cut live tree. A lit candle ignited paper decorations, tinsel, and dry needles. Mrs. W.G. Boland, mother of three children, who burned to death at the Babs Switch Schoolhouse, gave her version of the tragedy at a hospital the following night. I was on the committee, she said, and was under the tree helping to give out the presents when a candle set the tree on fire. I tried to beat it out with a paper sack, but did no good. At first, the crowd laughed and joked about the blaze. They said, "Look out, Santa Claus, you'll catch on fire." They laughed and joked. My boy, Dow, was acting as Santa Claus. The program was over. All the presents had been distributed, and Dow had handed out about 14 of 100 bags of candy and fruit to which the crowd was being treated when the fire started. Dow tried to smother it out with a blanket and then grabbed the curtain from the stage and tried to use it. The sheeting caught fire, and Dow, who was dressed up in a Santa Claus suit covered with cotton, was immediately enveloped by a sheet of flame.
Oof, man.
To watch you're there watching this happen to your child. Like,
he was one of the older ones that was like handing out candy and stuff to the younger kiddos.
Like, it's one thing to survive that, and then it's another thing to for that to have been the last thing you saw. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You there's no winning there. You either have to live with it or you die with that being your last image. Like, what the shit?
Yeah.
So that's something not fair. Panic spread. In an instant, the tree in the ceiling above it, stage curtains, and then the entire structure caught fire. No one laughed then.
No, and we have some clippings that I found from like actual newspaper clippings on the website, like where we post our sources and stuff. So the sirenspodcast.blogspot.com, we have a whole bunch of pictures and stuff on there, which I'll probably share into the group as well. Lily Biggers crawled out from under a desk and followed her mother. Like some other children escaping the fire, she grabbed a new toy on the way out, which was a doll. And actually that I have a photo at the very top, and that is like was a front page photo of her because she made it out with that doll. So it's her and that doll. And another child, a boy, somehow made his way into the building for his toy. Like he went back in for his new toy and never made it back out. Biggers and her daughters, Lily and Bessie, 12, survived the Christmas Eve fire in 1924. But the family's boys, William, who was 9, and Walter, who was 15, did not make it out. The fire burned Margaret Biggers' hand and arms so badly that her 4-year-old daughter, Lily, never shook the image of doctors tending to her mother. And decades later, Lily Biggers remembered her mother riding in the backseat of a Model T Ford with her damaged hand and arm out the window, trying to alleviate the excruciating pain with the cold air from outside. This was according to one of the other Biggers children. She said, "It had been traumatic for a little girl to see her mother in so much pain." This was a statement by Bill Braun, Lily Biggers Braun's 65-year-old son at the time that this interview was given, and almost all of this came from the Oklahoman, BT Dubs. So the panic crowd actually rushed towards the exit. The schoolhouse door, which only opened inward, and by the way, was the only exit.
Mm-hmm.
There was no other door, and all the other windows, they had actually covered and secured with like metal screens and rails and stuff to prevent vandals from breaking in. So there was no other way out. One boy was able to escape through a window because someone actually had succeeded in prying open a corner of one of those screens, but no one else was able to get out through any other windows. A few who escaped tried to return to save loved ones or pull a few lucky victims through the doors until flames and the surging mob inside made it impossible. So everyone was basically pushing up against that exit door that opened inwards. And because the crowd was pushing outwards, they just like they couldn't get the door open. There was too much panic. And the way that I understand it, at points, there was like a sliver of the door being opened and some people were able to like kind of pry their way out. And later, I think there's one guy that says he actually got down on the floor and crawled through the legs to get through that like little sliver of a door. One witness said, quote, "Heavy black smoke was pouring from the building and I had to send down as I worked in order to get my breath. When some men I helped tried to pull a boy from the bottom of the pile, he was already halfway out the door, but all-out strength was not enough to free him. The flames were pouring over us, and we had to just leave him. There he burned halfway on the outside. During the whole time I was at the door, I saw only 1 foot sticking from the pile of people. It was mostly hands and heads," end quote. You know what's crazy? I have been rereading It because it's like one of my favorite books in the world. Have you ever read It, by the way?
It? Stephen King? No, hell no. Mm-mm. No.
It's one of my favorite books of all.
No. Well, my imagination's too good. I can't.
So there's like a part in there about the black spot, and Stephen King fans, you'll know what I'm talking about, the black spot. But anyway, there was a massive fire at this black spot, and it was earlier in the, I want to say it was like in the teens or 20s that he had placed this in. And anyway, reading this, it's like almost verbatim that chapter in the book. And I'm wondering if...
You wonder what he knows. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it's like almost verbatim. It's insane. I'm just like wondering if he got some inspiration from this. Because this was in such national headlines over and over and over again, like every Christmas for a long time. I'm just wondering. Anyway, so another witness said, quote, her face pressed against the mesh window. Vesta Jackson looked out onto her brother Andrew Jackson and pleaded in a din that he could not bear to break through the barrier that separated her from the cooling snow haven outside. Others pushed against Vesta and beat on the window panes that broke, but the mesh, it clung to Vesta's cell window. Her brother, who was one of the first to escape the room, tore at the wire. His fingers bleeding, he smashed his large fist time after time into the wire. With each rebound of the fist, the hope crept from the soul of the girl. Vesta died in the arms of her sweetheart, Aubrey Coffey, who, by the way, they were supposed to be wed like a week later. When rescuers stepped gingerly into the charred ruins, they found Vesta and Aubrey and the other members of the Coffey family together. The milling mob at the door crawled, got on each other's shoulders to fight through the narrow exit. On the outside, those escaping from the inferno fought to get back to sons, daughters, and wives. Two elements clashed. Those in the rear in the schoolhouse mob was pushed into the crackling furnace. Burned body stench sickened the night air. I can't imagine. I know. So you are a medical person. I am a medical person. I have actually, I used to be in the OR, like an OR assistant during surgeries and stuff. And the smell of burnt flesh, I will just say, is something you never forget.
It takes a while to get it out of your nose, too. You got to cram mentholatum up your nostrils.
Yes. I mean, you know immediately what it is, and you never forget it. So I cannot imagine. And that's just like cauterizing. You know what I mean? Like, that's just, I can't imagine multiple bodies. Anyway.
And I don't know if hair or skin's worse. That's a toss-up.
You're right. Yeah, you're right. But imagine those two things mixing.
God. Oh.
yeah, so I mean it's bad. They said, he said, two gasoline lamps hanging on the side walls of the school building outside exploded, and that just made the flames even worse. They rose to the rooftop and just like made everything so much worse, according to several who escaped the schoolhouse. So it was such a small building. And I mean, like, your doctor's office is probably larger than what this building was. And to have all of these people packed in there, it was literally like sardines in there. Like, I'm not even sure why they decided to have this in such a small building in the first place, but
things like this, like, I'm sure there weren't big enough churches to house everybody. Like, there are still a lot of towns in Oklahoma that use schools as their gathering spot. Like, I've been to multiple funerals that were in gymnasiums. So if that's the spot that you have, like the biggest spot that you have to gather.
So the dead and injured were transported by car to Hobart, Oklahoma, which was the nearest sizable town. Like we said, it was like, what, 5-10 miles? And a makeshift morgue was set up in a downtown building. The next day, 32 people were reported to be dead and 37 were injured. And this was reported by the Hobart hospitals. So 4 died of their injuries, bringing the number of dead to 36. And just 15 of the 33 school children who attended that school survived the fire.
My God.
Yeah, and their ages ranged from, like, I want to say, I mean, if we include all of the children, we're talking, like, from babies all the way up to, like, 19, 20, and then so on. It did not discriminate by age. It was very sad.
Newspapers around the country carried stories about the fire. some accounts at the time noted an appreciation for the Hobart spirit, a precursor, some might say, to what became known as the Oklahoma Standard in the wake of the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. Owie.
Have you heard that before?
I wasn't ready for that. What, the Hobart spirit?
Not the Hobart spirit.
No, I've never heard that.
I've heard that all my life, and I never knew that that's where this stemmed from. So crazy.
I've kind of bounced around a lot, though. You know, I don't know. I have seldom, if ever, seen a community respond as has Hobart, wrote Walter T. Brown in a December 30th, 1924 Associated Press story published in the Hobart Democrat Chief. Switchboard and telegraph operators stayed at their posts for days. The mayor, the judge, the surgeons, ministers, mothers, daughters dropped everything to heal a community's wound. I cannot name all, he wrote. Newspaper columnists and politicians quickly framed the tragedy as a warning of what might happen when safety precautions are ignored in public buildings. In the wake of the fire, Oklahoma's legislature passed laws and pushed safety campaigns to prevent a similar tragedy, according to the Oklahoman Archives.
This incident was actually the game changer for schools that was the headway for businesses and just about any building that is accessed by the public. Completely changed like safety procedures and everything like that. And
that's why we have these like fire marshal codes and all this capacity.
Oh, yeah.
You know, all this kind of stuff. And like, you need to have this many exits. That's why those are in place, is because shit like this. Anyway, yeah. Officials evaluated schools throughout the state for fire hazards. Oklahoma schools replaced inward opening doors with doors that opened outward. Schools added exits and screens that could be opened from the outside. Purchased fire extinguishers for every room and banned open flames. Couldn't even have a Bunsen burner in a lab no more. Fire escapes were added to multi-level school buildings. The movement stretched beyond schools and beyond Oklahoma as public policy nationwide shifted toward eliminating fire hazards in all public buildings. Still, the changes took time, and that cost more lives. Between 1908 and 1958, school fires in just 8 states, including Oklahoma's Babswitch fire, would kill at least 755 people, according to the National Fire Protection Association. Following the Chicago fire, oh my god, the Chicago fire.
Yeah.
That was in that time. Oh, man. How do I know about a Chicago fire, not the Babswitch? I mean, that was the domino effect. You know what I mean? That was the one.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyways, kind of like Columbine. Like, that one stands out.
Yep. And this one was actually before the Chicago fire.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, you say Chicago fire and I know. Anyways, that's nuts.
Yeah.
Following the Chicago fire, states enacted better fire safety codes for schools and more strictly enforce existing codes, said Robert Solomon, division manager for Building and Life Safety Code for the National Fire Protection Association. Robert, could you shorten your title just a little bit?
Please. Especially if you're going to be quoted all the time.
That's a lot. Big title. Until then, school fire tragedies, often in small communities or rural areas, had failed to spark any widespread reforms. Solomon believes the location of the Chicago fire in a large media market, combined with horrifying images of children at the windows, gelled a nationwide movement to make school buildings safer. Newspapers from all around the country printed the story, and people sent more than $12,000 to help cover medical and burial costs. The bodies of the two little boys from the Biggers family who died on Christmas Eve were identified by the objects they had carried. Oh, this is going to hurt. William, 9, held a toy gun. Walter, 15, wore a belt buckle. The children were among the victims, buried side by side in coffins along a mass grave in Hobart Rose Cemetery. The Babswitch School was replaced in August 1925. When the district was annexed into Hobart and Roosevelt in 1943, Babswitch closed for good. Today, a stone monument marks the spot where the burned schoolhouse once stood. It's 4 miles south of Hobart. Wow, we could have just...
Boom. Okay, nailed it.
On US 183, a quiet spot near a picnic table. From there, the memorial, like the tragedy, is in the distance, yet never too far away.
And I think I added photos somewhere, and I will, I'll share that stuff to the group. But there was actually photos of the burial, like, of them burying in this mass grave, and it was like, ugh.
You have it underneath the monument.
Yeah. Thanks. I hate it.
I hate it.
So... Yeah, all right. So, okay. All right. So here's the part that we've This is the reason why we included this, because I know you guys are sitting there thinking, okay, this was a horrible accident, granted, but it was an accident. It's not true crime. Well, let me tell you why. One child, a 3-year-old, whose name was Mary Edens, was reported as missing from the fire, but her body was never found. Her Aunt Alice, Noah, who escaped the building, but then she died several days later in the hospital, said that she recalled carrying Mary out of the building and handing her to someone that she did not know. Because 3-year-old Mary Eden's body was not recovered, her parents hoped that she had somehow survived the fire. We let the assumptions fly. What happened to Mary Edens? Every year around Christmas, like I said, one or another Oklahoma newspaper would publish an account of this fire. This would spread nationwide. The stories usually included an account of this missing Mary Edens. In the fall of 1956, a Babswitch story caught the eye of Elmont H. Place, a district governor of the Lions Club in San Bernardino, California. Grace Reynolds was a friend of his and had confided that she had never felt at home with her family and often wondered if she had another past. Then he was just like, well, maybe you're the Edens girl.
What the fuck? Just such a...
Yeah. It was such a leap. Just because someone says, like, and I want to reiterate the fact that up until this point, Grace Reynolds had absolutely no evidence that she had been adopted or that her family was not her family or anything like that. At no point, she was just like, I'm the black sheep of my family, and there has to be another explanation.
Here. Maybe I'm from Oklahoma. Yeah.
Place wrote to a fellow Lion, Wayne Fitt, asking for information about the Edens family. So Fitt then contacted Betty Reynolds. Okay, yes, these people have the same last names, but the married names of Betty and Grace were just like a coincidence, apparently.
Well, I mean, there were only like 300 people in all of America back then. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. So yeah, Betty, who was born to the Edens family after Mary disappeared, but Fitt wrote back, and his letter illustrates the hope and heartache of the Edens search.
Oh my God.
So his letter said, quote, Mrs. Reynolds asked me not to contact her parents because they have only recently closed a similar case where another girl matched the description perfectly, and their hopes were built up that the long search had ended only to find by blood test that they were wrong again. What? Mr. and Mrs. Edens have carried on a constant search since the night of the tragedy. They have had detectives working on this case off and on since that date. And they have turned up many finds that they thought were the real thing until some small detail dissolved the whole case, end quote. So, yes, this was the 50s. Back then, DNA tests included. So, basically, the DNA tests in the 50s were, well, they could test you and they could tell you that you were not related to a certain person. But, or they could say, yes, you're in the same familial bloodline or something like that. But they weren't able to tell you, like, yes, that person is your mom, or yes, that person is your sister, like we can today. Like, it was just basically either, yes, you're related by a certain percentage, or no, you're not.
Oh, I and have so many questions. Like, what?
I know.
What DNA markers did they have in the 50s? Like, I can't help but wonder if this wasn't just like ABO typing, and they were like, and they didn't realize the pyramid of like how it could have been. You know what I mean? You'd have to have like, your mom's a B and your dad's an O, you could be this.
Yeah. I'm not a genealogist. I have not studied DNA extensively, especially like back in that era. So your guess is as good as mine. All I know is that apparently this DNA test could tell you whether you were or were not related, but it couldn't tell you if like we were sisters. I don't know how accurate they were. I mean, hell, we know that hair testing from the 70s was bullshit. Like, so.
And 80s.
Yeah, so
very much bullshit. Oh, it's a dog hair. Our bad. I need to go apartment tomorrow and ask some
questions. Exactly.
I'll get back.
So we know that was we know that was basically junk science then. So I'm not I don't know. I would love to have a DNA expert like explain this, but anyway.
I'll just go. There's a department for this. I'll go over there tomorrow and be like, "Can I bend your ear a bit?"
Hey, I would love to know, like seriously. So so apparently they had DNA tested several other women claiming to have been this missing Mary Edens that just would like turn up out of the woodwork. And I'm guessing the reason being is because the family themselves had a bit of money.
It had to have been. Otherwise, what the fuck is wrong with people? Why would you do this?
Of course. Of course.
Yeah. But anyway, so a lot of people had come out of the woodwork and had said, oh, I'm their missing daughter that's, you know, around kind of the same age. And then they would do a blood test and they go, no, you're not. And
I don't fit in with my peasant family. I feel richer than them. I've got to be her.
So stupid. So Mary's sister sent photographs. By February 2nd, they and Grace Reynolds had submitted blood for testing. Grace also had a small scar on the arch of her foot that, according to Mary's family, she had the same exact scar.
Oh, what?
I don't know. That's something that you could learn somehow and do that to yourself. Anyway. So they set up a reunion, which occurred February 9th of 1957, and the Edens were absolutely convinced and overjoyed. Now, they set up this reunion before the DNA test came back. I just want to make that clear. But they were convinced before the DNA test came back that this was their daughter. So they didn't really care much about anything after that. I have a quote here from Ethel Edens. She said, "We've been through this several times before when we thought we had found our girl." She told this to Hobart Democrat Chief for its February 10th, 1957 edition. She said, "We were afraid we'd be hurt some more, but this time it's the real thing." This is, I feel like, just seriously taking advantage of a sad mother. You know what I mean? Like,
it's disgusting.
They haven't even waited. And I am going to assume that DNA testing took a while to come back then. So this whole time they're waiting on this DNA testing to come back, and she's just acting like she's the missing kid and everybody's acting like it's totally fine.
You know what a narcissist would tell themselves? That they're doing a good thing because they're bringing peace to this woman. And it's just like a white lie.
Oh, yeah.
She doesn't know. Now she's got closure. Yeah.
Which I, no. Mm-mm.
That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works.
No. That story in particular had actually made newspapers from California to North Dakota to Michigan, like all over the United States. And on March 27th, 1957, the newly found Mary Edens and her parents appeared on the Ark Linkletter TV show House Party, which is apparently a pretty big deal back then. I have no idea what this TV show is.
I've never heard of that. And I'm like, Captain Throwback. I don't know. Ark Linkletter.
I've heard of it before. And I want to say that it was somewhat like a late night show or a talk show of some sort. House Party was an American radio daytime variety talk show that aired on CBS and ABC from 1945 to 1967. So there you go.
It's a variety show that definitely had bands.
Yeah. It says it was a TV show, but it also says it was a radio show. So I guess it dually aired. Anyway, so they were on there, which was apparently a big deal. So get this. Okay. After that, Grace Reynolds just immediately starts using her newfound name. Okay. She immediately starts going by Mary Edens. She starts making the celebrity circuit in Hobart. Okay. Like, everybody wants to talk to her. Everybody wants to interview her. Everybody wants to know where she was, what she was doing. And someone in California who knew something of Grace's past was placing a telephone call to a local newspaper. Uh-oh.
actually have the telegrams here. Yes, telegrams. I did not misspeak. So the first hint that Grace Reynolds might not be the Eden's daughter sent to the Democrat chief editor Al Adams on February 19th, 1957. It's going to take every bone in my body to not say stop at each period. Confidential, stop. Have information, stop.
I mean, well, that's how they relayed it. So...
I know.
Give us the real feeling. I'm just kidding.
So it said, confidential, have information, Grace Reynolds representing self as daughter of Mr. and Mrs. L.F. Edens, your city, maybe imposter, believe her to be daughter of Mrs. Goldie Thomas and former husband, Tom Gaither. Please give additional details. Means of identification, financial circumstances of Edens. We will exchange our information for anything more that you can provide on this case. The telegram was sent by Mel Bennett of the Stockton Record, which was a newspaper in Stockton, California. So they took the story after Dorothy Link called. She had seen an Associated Press photograph of Grace Reynolds with the Edens, and Link knew Grace Reynolds. In fact, she claimed to be Grace's sister. So within weeks, the Stockton Record had obtained from Goldie Thomas a notarized statement dated May 16th, 1957, which made a startling claim. It said, quote, I hereby certify that Grace Leona Reynolds Gaither is my lawful daughter. She was born July 11th, 1923, on a farm near Cotton Plant, Woodruff County, Arkansas. This would make her one at the time of the fire, not three. But also, her mom, this is her mom, her real mom. And her mom is like, I don't know what the hell she's talking about. She's my kid. I literally birthed her.
Do you want to see the hospital?
There was a witness there, apparently, when she was born, a midwife there, who was like 45 years old at the time that attended the birth. And like, it was just like everybody, all of her family was going, I don't understand what is happening here. Like, she's our family. She's my kid. She's my sister. I don't understand what
rabid is animal.
I mean, at this point I'd be like, yeah, no, I don't know that bitch.
Off her rocker. Coombe listed three younger sisters. Grace's younger sister, Dorothy, had been married to and divorced from Alfred R. Reynolds. 6 years after that divorce, Grace married her sister's ex-husband.
Her sister's ex-husband.
You fucking tramp. Get out of it. Seriously. Oh my God. There's a million men in the world. What is with you? You got to just meet everyone at the fucking Christmas, family Christmas party. Like, wow. This lady. That's a stretch for that word. Anyways. And Coon suggested that anger at Grace may have prompted Link to call to the newspaper. Link also said that Grace's claim made her mother appear to be a kidnapper. Link showed Coon a letter from her sister, Inez Collins, which said in part, what do you think of Sister Grace now? New name, new family, money. She should be pretty well happy, don't you think? That's the most absurd thing I think I've ever heard of. I'd like to punch her in the nose.
Oh, don't you just love the sister?
Yes. Inez can sit beside me any day. Come here.
No shit.
I love it. About 10 years before this reunion, Link said Grace had begun to tell people that she had no family. When confronted about this, Grace replied that she would be less likely to land a job in a first-rate department store if people knew she came from a poor people's family.
Not cool, Grace.
Don't even fucking get me started on how not cool Grace is. Coon confronted Grace Reynolds with this information and sent this telegram to the Democrat chief.
You know you want to do it.
Stop! Grace Reynolds, reach her! Barstow! Okay, Grace Reynolds, reach her. Barstow, California Dress Shop, advised of notarized statement. Said plans consult attorney before making statement. I can't make any sort of statement at the present time, she said. Asked whether she persists in claim she's Eden's daughter. replied, "I'm not claiming nothing yet. Hold story until Wednesday. May hear from her tomorrow." Between the work of both newspapers, they were close to publishing a story that would rock the town of Hobart, where the return of the long-lost Mary Edens had brought a measure of healing. In a letter to Ransom Hancock, that is the coolest fucking name I've ever heard.
Right, that's what I said.
Fuck yeah. I love it. Okay, sorry. Oh, wow. No. Rock my girl, Ransom Hancock. Okay. In a letter to Ransom Hancock, reporter Kuhn concluded, "This letter will also serve to confirm our agreement to break this story simultaneously on Wednesday, May 22nd, 1957. But the Democrat chief never published its story. Ooh, you sneaky snake.
I want to say just real quick, by the way, I never saw anywhere out of all the resources that I went through for this, I never saw anywhere where they got the DNA test back and whether it was positive or negative. I never saw that. So I don't know what happened to that DNA test.
I seriously think they just didn't give a shit. They're like, oh, yeah. Trust the matter.
Yeah.
I just took a DNA test. Anyway. Turns out I'm 100% a fake. Now that he had what he thought was irrefutable proof that Grace Reynolds was an imposter, Ransom Hancock was honor bound to show his evidence. Joe Hancock, who took over the paper from his father, remembers the day. "Dad, I went to Lewis with this information before Mrs. Reynolds came back in June," Joe says. "Dad took all this information, met with Lewis at his house, maybe in the yard. Dad was really shook up having to tell him, and Lewis went through the trauma of finding out. Then Lewis Edens asked his friend for a consideration, a favor that has kept the story about Grace Reynolds out of the newspaper. Lewis Edens said to Ransom Hancock, 'Look, my wife believes this girl. She believes she's found her daughter.' Lewis Edens asked to withhold the story until his wife's death. Dad said, 'I just can't run that.' And he didn't," Joe says. "We had the information in the safe at the office in an envelope. Dad took it many years later to Delbert Braun. Delbert was a historian of the Babs Fire. Dad told Delbert, 'Here it is, and I hope you'll honor Lewis's request that it be kept secret.'" Oh, such a gentleman's code between these guys. Instead of publishing a story with the Stockton Record, the Democrat chief published it simultaneously with the Oklahoman decades later. Joe Hancock shared the long secret letters and telegrams even as he decided to close this chapter in his newspaper. "We decided that now is the time to tell it," Joe says. "Some of the people here through the years have questioned Grace's story and are suspicious of it. Every time there's been an anniversary, like the 50th, it comes up. 'Cause she's a phony."
Yeah.
Joe Hancock concluded his revelation in Thursday's Democrat chief with these words: "Now, 75 years after the fire, with only two known survivors, it's time to set the record straight." Oh shit, that's such a mic drop sentence right there. Kind of like, yeah. We need to talk. Like, what's happening?
Yeah.
Mary Elizabeth Edens was in all probability burned with 35 other good Kiowa County folk. He is proud of his father's decision, which Joe says reflects a humanity that's been lost in modern journalism. It ain't no shit.
He said, "I hope we don't get away from having some feeling for the survivors. What good would have come from publishing the story? Mr. Edens knew she was a hoax. Mrs. Edens believed the story and accepted her for her daughter. I'm sure that gave her peace that she never would have gotten." And then for nearly half a century, the owners of this town newspaper have known the truth about Lewis Edens' missing daughter and never reported it. I'm torn on this, just real quick, because I think that if I ever found out that my husband didn't tell me that this was not my daughter, I think I would want to know that it wasn't my daughter. You know, like,
I know. And sometimes men and women were they're protective of us and we are nurturers. They're protective, we're nurturers. Yeah. Back and forth, back and forth. And
by nature.
Yes. And those two lines can really, really fucking blur. And especially when you think of back then, whenever they had like fucking archaic roles, you know, man and woman wise, and then a gentleman's code. And it's just not uncommon that men would just stand on the fucking street corner talking with their hands in their pockets while women are like inside making dinner, you know? It's just one of those social things. And it's probably like a, it's a miracle for a couple to stay together after the loss of their child, period.
Yeah.
If they're missing, if they're dead, if they're murdered, if there was an accident, whatever. A lot of times that will shatter the love that two people used to have. It broke something. I don't fucking know. So I don't know why. I'm not a fucking psychologist. But for them to still, him to still want to, I don't know. You want your wife back. You want your wife to be happy. You want your wife to be normal. You cannot watch her go through that again.
Of course, we don't know what goes on behind closed doors. She may have said something in passing, like whether this is it or not, it is for me or something like that. I mean, we just don't know. So
yeah, who knows?
I mean, I'm trying really hard not to judge. So
yes. And I know, like, my partner knows, like, if there's a fucking dead animal on the side of the road, like, either distract me or don't, like, never point it out. Don't talk to me about it. Like, do not fucking talk to me about it. If it's on Facebook, if there's some story, or if there's this, that, whatever, like, he will go out of his way to protect me from it.
Yeah.
That's what they do. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I get that. I get that.
But then there's also the whole patriarchy thing that I just fucking, I just can't with it. So,
well,
who knows?
And like you said, this is, oh my gosh, was 70 years now ago? That's a pretty long time ago. And yeah, there was almost a completely different world back then. So
I mean, they were just inventing microwaves. I mean, fuck.
I truly believe in my heart that he was trying to do what he thought was best. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
That's what
absolutely.
I believe.
Whether that was the right thing actually or not, who
exactly. Know. Exactly. Exactly. I mean, and we'll never know because these people kept that secret for that long. So, and apparently this Ransom Hancock's son, Joe, felt the same way. He said, I think it was a tough decision. I know that if I would have had the wisdom to do that or not, he doesn't know. He said, I don't see any reason to have hurt that family. I can't imagine the trauma of losing a child in a fire and not knowing what happened to her. Can you imagine how you'd feel years later, never having found a body? And that is another point.
Everybody else is accounted for. Where the shit is she?
So many different things could have happened. We now know that this was a hoax. This person was not the Mary Edens that went missing. And there's a lot of different speculation. So when Mary's aunt handed her off to someone that she did not know, anything could have happened. Though that person could have been like, this is a great opportunity to take advantage of the chaos and have myself a child. Or, I mean, I don't know if child trafficking was a thing back then. I assume that trafficking has always been a thing. This person could have simply just set the child down and she could have wandered off. I mean, at the time, this was just nowhere land, so her body could still be in the woods around there somewhere. Or someone could have picked her up and taken her to a nearby hospital where she may have died from wounds or whatever there and then was sent to the morgue and never identified. I mean, so many things could have happened. So many things.
It's just such a tiny community, a middle of nowhere community. Like, they're all gonna fucking know each other. Like, I don't understand how a whole ass child can go missing from this scene if she did not die in that building.
Bigger belief on my part is that I think she was taken to a hospital, and I think she either passed away at one of those hospitals or she was taken from said hospital. If she was actually taken, as in kidnapped, they would have, like you said, everybody knows everybody there. They would have probably known to take her as far away from there as possible. So there's no telling.
Like, if you just look at how many people that we know in Ada, and we haven't lived there in years. Like, so imagine that tiny town, and that's all they've ever known, and they've been there. You know, like, I don't know. Somebody would have known whose fucking kid that was.
You would think so.
Someone knows.
Which is another reason why I think it's really likely that she also just wandered off, like, into the woods.
Wasn't she, like, 2? How old was she?
She was 3, and it was nighttime, and it was dark, and it was cold, and this freaking building was on fire in front of her. She could have just been terrified. Someone could have set her down. I mean, she could have just ran off.
God, so I want to know. You know what? I just wonder about Back to the Future sometimes. Like, if I had that fucking car, I'd just try to go figure out all this kind of shit.
That's what I said.
I wouldn't go back into my own life. I'd go back and be like,
no.
I would sit with JonBenet Ramsey all fucking night long.
Yes.
Be like,
yes.
What happened? Like,
freaking preach. That's exactly me. So we know what we're doing with our DeLorean.
Yeah, exactly. Fucking get in, loser. We're going crime stopping.
Grace was never outed. Even after the mother passed away, she still went by Mary Edens. She eventually got married and it changed to Mary Edens Grossnickel. Apparently back in the day, you did not have to go down and like legally change your name or anything. You could just like go by whatever you wanted to, whenever you wanted to.
What the hell?
Which is another thing that we might discuss with the child, the missing child. I mean, back then you didn't have to have any sort of papers or anything. If someone actually took the child, I'm just saying, you know, papers as in birth certificate.
The document, you're definitely a dog mom.
I know.
It's got papers.
But it's got papers. It's got papers.
Child has papers.
Look. But I mean, like, it was easier to just become whoever you wanted to be back then, or pretend like someone else was someone they weren't back then.
That's
so
insane.
I mean, I don't know. 42 years after she first arrived in Hobart, she still claims that she's the Edens' lost daughter.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Like, up to her death, she still claimed that she was their lost daughter.
Get off it.
Yeah. After years of running restaurants in Idaho and Yellowstone Park, she settled in Colorado eventually, where this interviewer reached her by telephone, got a statement from her that she said that the doubters don't bother her. She said, quote, "I really don't care what they think. It just bounces off of me. There was too many things that proved out before." I'm not sure what that means, but you're wrong, but moving on.
Get off the gas, whatever your name is. Shit.
And then of her younger sister, Betty, Mary said that Betty was just jealous of the attention that she got when she returned to Hobart. So, I don't know. She said, quote, "My younger sister, she just fully and totally and completely accepted me too until the new wore off," she said. Apparently, her childhood was rough with her original family. She said, and from the time that she was 5 or 6 years old, she was, quote, "farmed out to any family that needed a hand around the house."
That's the awesome way to say pimped.
Yeah, farmed out.
Farm my ride. I can't.
So of the notarized statement by Goldie Moore, she said she wasn't surprised that she had signed it. This is a quote by Mary/Grace. She was scared, quote, "if she wasn't my birth mother, then she was a kidnapper." Like, it's so stupid. You're claiming your own mother kidnapped you. That's just... Etta Henderson, who lives in Oklahoma City, is one of the Edens' daughters. Like everyone else, she was excited about Mary's return and believed they had found their sister. But after their father learned the truth from Ransom Hancock, the doubts began. Her parents traveled to California and actually visited Grace's birth mother and two sisters, and were still apparently convinced that she was Mary Edens. So Grace and her son lived with the Edens for a while, and then with Etta, which was her sister, not sister, and her family. Mary's son, Lee, still contacts Etta occasionally and still calls her aunt, which is fine with Etta, apparently. She likes Lee. She has no illusions, however, about Grace. This is what Etta said. "My daddy figured it out real quick, but we did not want to hurt our mother. I'm not saying she's an imposter. I wouldn't. But I'm saying she's not my sister." So I'm not saying she's an imposter, but I'm saying she's an imposter. I love that. So the lady claiming to be Mary would go on to write a book in 1980 called Mary, Child of Tragedy, the story of the lost child of the 1924 Babs Switch Fire. Could you come up with a longer freaking title?
Oh, what's his nut? That guy.
Yeah, I know. The fire guy. The fire guy.
The fire guy. Hey, we figured it out.
And then, like I said, this woman claimed to be Mary up until the day of her death, and she died in Colorado when she was 86 years old, I think just a couple years ago. So what happened to the real Mary Edens? Who knows? There's so many different theories about this. There are still people out there, because now everybody knows that this is a hoax. There are still people out there claiming that their mother was the real Mary Edens and so on and so forth. But I just want to reiterate the fact that her body was never found. There was never a body found that was identified to have been or to have even possibly been Mary Edens. So what happened to the real Mary Edens? We will probably never know.
No, it's getting way too far. Like, she gone.
It's just an unsolved mystery that will probably never, ever be solved. Unless, I mean, eventually we find bones somewhere, somehow.
Oh! But, like, then will we have anything to compare the bones to?
Well, I mean, the family did so many DNA tests that I'm sure that there are still, like, there's still DNA on file somewhere.
Something somewhere.
That you could probably run a new DNA test on and match up with. So I'm sure it's in the database now, but like you'd have to have a body to compare it to. So, and it's Oklahoma. I mean, I'm not saying it's still the Wild West out here, but there's still a lot of open spaces and a lot of places that like just the public or people just can't really get to. A lot of Oklahoma is owned by like farmers, and they own like hundreds and hundreds of acres.
Yeah,
stuff like that.
Yeah.
It could be hundreds of years before we know or never know at all. But anyway, so that is the story of the Babs Christmas Fire and the missing Mary Edens.
No matter how many y'all bitches say that's your name, she's missing.
So there you go. We love you out there, and we'll see you after the new year.
Bye-bye.
Well, this is our Christmas episode, and it looks like it's going to be our New Year's episode as well. So,
Merry Christmas! Happy New Year!
Merry Christmas! Happy New Year! We hope that your New Year's resolution is to not murder people.
Eat a cheese cube.
Eat some cheese. Have some wine.
It's probably just low blood sugar. You're not really that angry.
Chill the fuck out.
Peanut butter crackers. Bye.
You've reached the end of our episode. All suspects are innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Join Raven next time on the Sirens Podcast.
Do we have an outro? That's our outro, isn't it?